Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the code of ethics that governs a mysterious gathering in the desert, and a conversation with Congressman Juan Ciscomani about the conservative point of view on climate change. But first, if you are a regular show listener, you know we usually close out the week with our newscap segment, where we have a couple of guests here in the studio to bring you a bird's eye view roundup of what's happening in news and politics. And today, we're going to bring you a segment with a similar setup, but a slightly different focus. Culture. Think of it as Culture Cap. And for the first edition, the topic is Phoenix. With me here in the studio is the editor-in-chief of Phoenix Magazine, Craig Outier. Good morning, Craig.
Hey, Sam. How are you?
And we also have one of the producers of this very show, who is also a musician and plays shows around the city, Amber Victoria Singer. Hey, Amber.
Hello.
So let me lay out the framework here. Because one thing I want to be very clear about right at the top is that this conversation will, of course, be limited by our respective perspectives. I'm under no delusion that we are going to definitively assess Phoenix culture in this conversation. We've all got blind spots and limitations in our perceptions of life here. But that said, we're also each plugged into what goes on here in interesting ways, both of my guests, probably even more than me. And that's how I actually want to set this up for you guys, because I'm just a couple weeks removed from my one-year anniversary of living here. And in the course of that year, I've done dozens and dozens of stories for the show with a particular focus on arts and culture. And I think that I have come up with three words that, in my mind, describe something essential about the cultural community here. So what I would like to do, Craig and Amber, is to pitch you these words and see if you agree with them. Or if you disagree, which you're also, to be clear, welcome to do. The first word is sincerity. I feel like I have detected such a strong level of sincerity in so many of the people that I've spoken to here. And I think one of the reasons this stands out to me is because I moved here from New York, where, in my opinion at least, the culture is a little bit more defined by a sense of irony and sarcasm. And particularly when it comes to people's passions about things, it's like you have to apologize for your passion before you express it. And here, one of the first people I met was a guy named Michael Ring. Amber, we actually met this guy together at the Phoenix Herpetological Sanctuary. And one of the first things he said was, "I consider myself a sage." And I thought that was such a remarkable thing to say. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying that to make light of what he said. Like, he was a sage. He gave me really, really good advice in terms of how to really kind of address life in the desert in a direct way. And I also interviewed a guy named David Payne, who's been playing Winston Churchill at Phoenix Theater. He came in and spoke about how what he really connected with about Winston Churchill was his relationship with his wife, and that was because David himself had recently lost his wife. He started crying right here in the studio talking about it. And I said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put you in that position. He was like, no, that's the reality of it. And so I've been really moved by experiences like that. So Craig, let me start with you. What do you make of this? Do you think I'm onto something here or do you disagree?
Well, at first I was kind of taken aback because, you know, I like irony.
Sure.
I like sarcasm, snark, parody, all of that. Those are great tools to have, you know, and frankly, a lot of great art arises from all of that.
Absolutely.
So I was thinking maybe it just means our art is not as good. But there is maybe a sincerity out here. Some people would say maybe an extremism, you know, extremism, mm-hmm. that, you know, it's a lack of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. But I think you might be onto something. And I can think of examples where that's not the case, but a lot of examples where it is.
Any particularly sincere moments come to mind?
Well, you know, you talk about the gentleman who described himself as sage. And there is sort of a mysticism, a desert mysticism that I think yeah. creeps into a lot of a lot of lifestyle here that is kind of free of irony. Mm-hmm. You know, and that can be good and bad. It can be kind of product and packaged and feel artificial, but a lot of cases it's incredibly sincere. And So yeah, you know, those are kind of the general thoughts I had about it.
Sure, sure. Amber, what about you? What do you make of this sincerity thing?
I feel like there's a perception of people who live, like 20-somethings who live in Phoenix, particularly downtown Phoenix, that they like think they're in LA. And I hear a lot of like, stop acting like that, you're not in LA. Like, you're not too cool to be here. This is Phoenix. But even from like, I've talked to folks who run like DIY spaces, DIY music spaces in Tucson, and they'll say like, when I go to Phoenix, like people are not having as much fun at shows. Like people are not dancing as much. People do not look like they're enjoying themselves, which I've seen both. I've seen people enjoying themselves and I've seen people standing in the back with their arms crossed looking too cool. But I will say the one show that we had played outside of Phoenix in Flagstaff was like, people were like moshing to our stuff. Like no one had ever danced around like that when we played. Mostly it was the arms crossed, head nodding. So I feel like there's maybe some idea that people think they are too cool for Phoenix. A lot of people move to LA from here. I personally think there's nothing wrong with acting cool in Phoenix. I think it's a cool city.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's interesting. Something that I hear in that is, and a little bit in what both of you are saying, is this sense of people recognizing a certain maybe distance from what they see as reality and others and kind of challenging them to say like, no, we're here. This is Phoenix. Like, wake up.
Right. Sort of a mutual, I think we talked about this earlier, kind of a sense of mutual suffering. You know, you're in it. You're one of us.
We're all sweating.
You know, you kind of made a comment earlier. It reminded me of that Todd Browning movie, Freaks, One of Us, you know, that kind of thing. I think once you touch down here at Sky Harbor, you kind of feel that.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, with that in mind, I'm going to jump ahead to my third word. I was going to do this one second, but since you bring that up, Craig, the third word that I was going to bring up, which will now be the second word, is struggle. And I think what I also mean here a little bit is like defiance. This was actually inspired, Craig, by a conversation you and I had on the air here where you were talking about wine here and how you can kind of taste the struggle in the grapes.
Taste the struggle, right.
Because it's not necessarily...
You can taste it in the people too.
Well, a little anecdote I wanted to share is I read this book by Richard Grant called A Race to the Bottom of Crazy. And in each of in each chapter of that book, he has a little anecdote that he describes as sort of iconically the Valley or maybe Arizona more broadly. And the one that really sticks in my memory is about this guy who drove out into the desert with a revolver because he wanted to shoot a saguaro. And he did that, and he shot the saguaro, and the saguaro promptly tipped over and fell on his head and killed him, which is obviously terrible. But I have found...
Is it?
Well...
it's not the way I want to go.
not the way I would like to.
Oh, terrible for him, no question.
Well, it just made me think about a lot of people I've met here who are doing things that might actually kill them, but they're still doing them. Like I did
like
a
breathing.
Breathing is one of those basic things.
Hiking camelback in the summer.
There it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
But I also I met this guy named Dwayne Jensen who fixes analog typewriters here, and he was an incredibly insightful, thoughtful guy. And he was having trouble breathing as we were speaking. He was actually hooked up to a breathing machine. And he has a lung condition that was in part brought on by the chemicals he has to use to fix these typewriters. But he's still doing it because it's that important to him. And I just was so stirred by the profundity of the import of his work to him. So what do you guys make of that? I mean, do you think struggle is a key part of life here?
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned him specifically because the reason a lot of people moved here originally, not originally, but early 20th century, the first kind of, you know, large migration was to escape lung ailments because of the, you know, dry, warm climate. So in that part of it, it wasn't, you know, it was a better climate to be part of. But there's always been struggle wedded into the, you know, especially the Phoenix existence. I think that's, you know, that's part of what binds us together, I think, psychically here is the sense that if our air conditioning went out, we might all just, you know, die.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely, I feel like, a hustle aspect to it. Like, I see more and more people on Roosevelt like every Saturday and Sunday, like literally all day sitting out there trying to sell their art. And it's like, I don't have the patience for that. I don't have the tolerance for the heat. And I just think that that's definitely a struggle people are think is worth sitting through to sell their art or like get their art out there, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Seasonal struggle.
Seasonal struggle. Yeah. I always say I have seasonal amnesia because as soon as it dips under 90, I'm like, why would I ever leave?
Seasonal amnesia.
Yeah. Right.
That's the thing that another part of living here is that initially after you move, this is my last summer. I'm going to find a way to get out of town. And then the winters are so lovely. You're kind of like, forget it. I'll just stay one more summer.
Yeah, seasonal amnesia. All right, well, this is the Culture Cap here on the show. We'll have lots more in just a moment. Good morning, and welcome back to the show, where we're bringing you the first installment of our Wednesday Culture Cap. I'm Sam Dingman, here with Phoenix Magazine Editor-in-Chief Craig Outier and show producer Amber Victoria Singer. Before the break, I said that I had three words to describe Phoenix culture. I only revealed two of them. That's what's known as a cliffhanger in the biz.
And what a cliffhanger it was.
Yes. So get ready for this appropriately sort of sincere resolution to the cliffhanger. The third word that I would submit to you really describes Phoenix culture to me is service. Something that I have noticed, in particular with the artists that I've met here, is there's a sense in their work that it's not just for them. It is for them and of them, of course. But there is such a recurrent belief for me that by doing this work, they're doing something to lift up the whole city or a particular community in the city or to draw the city's attention to something that's really important to them. Two examples of that I wanted to share with you. One is I spoke to a mixed media artist recently named Joan Barron, who is doing this project called Tiny Prayer Space. Some of you may have visited Tiny Prayer Space, which is a room in Phoenix that Joan has created where people can come in and make these beads. And the only prompt is to think about each life lost in the conflict between Israel and Hamas, not in support or against either side of that, but just the lives lost, a place to come and think about that loss. It's a very moving and profound conversation. And I also spoke to a photographer named Stacey Iannacone, who did this photographic project called Vacant Visions that was about derelict buildings around the city that have sort of been left to rot. And she told me that one of the reasons that this project was important to her was to get people to notice, like, we're letting this happen to classic architecture in a city that's not that old. And that seemed like it was a really important part of this for her, in addition to creating really lovely, compelling visual images. So as my last word pitch to you guys, what do you make of this idea of service?
I was a little skeptical when I saw it,
okay,
to be honest with you. I mean, the examples you mentioned are incredibly valid, and I can think of many examples as well that support your thesis there. But I've also seen so many examples of rank self-interest and ambition,
sure,
like any big city. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to think of ways where, you know, what you're saying is true. And I the first thing I thought of was not the artist community or what you might think of as the progressive community, but the conservative one. Like, why is, for instance, libertarianism such a big thing here? It's a birthplace of libertarianism. And I personally find the whole concept kind of preposterous, but there are people who truly believe it here. And, you know, the Goldwater Institute is here.
Right.
And they clearly believe it in a way that maybe is not just about short-term gain for themselves. Maybe they think it really is uplifting a community and a culture and a nation. I don't think so. But that part of the valley has always been here.
Yeah.
And, you know, it swings both ways politically.
Sure.
And I don't know if it's because, you know, we were a frontier state until, you know, pretty recently. And maybe it was just you didn't have the luxury of uncertainty and or, you know, you had to be community minded to make a go of it.
Yeah.
It's possible.
I definitely feel like the Goldwater Institute believes that they're really fighting for something bigger than themselves. It does feel like that. But I mean, even in the arts, too, there's things like Zony Girls, which was they were doing like pop-up rollerblading rinks or roller skating rinks and other things before they had their own shop. It was kind of like a community first, business second kind of thing, building that community, making space for them. I feel like there's been a lot of natural disasters over the past year, and there were a lot of benefit art and music events for them. And it's like, we're not even in the state where it's happening, and you still have people that care so deeply about like relief efforts that they're trying to raise money in any way they can.
Yeah. Well, in the vein of perhaps libertarianism slightly, that's another cliffhanger. The other thing I wanted to do today was this exercise that is slightly borrowed from the writer Elizabeth Gilbert. This is something my wife and I like to do. We call it the thought bubble exercise. And the idea here is to come up with the phrase that is in the thought bubble hovering above everybody's head in some given place. So as an example, one thing that she and I like to say is the thought bubble for New York City is get out of my way. And you can obviously interpret that in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know if both of you have a phrase you think would be in the thought bubble that hovers above the head of Phoenicians.
That's a good question.
We talked about this a little bit earlier, of like every summer, it's like, this is my last summer here.
Yeah.
So my thought bubble is, how much longer can I do this? It feels like everyone, almost everyone I talk to, Phoenix is like not the final destination. It's like a stop along the way. It's always like, where do you want to live? And it's never like somewhere else in Arizona. It's always like, oh, Boston, Chicago, Seattle, like one of the cities that are above us in our fifth largest city ranking.
Right.
But it does feel like, I know like very few people who are like, I'm going to live and die in Tempe, Arizona.
So how much longer can I do this?
Yeah.
Right. That could be it. Uh-huh. It could be, you know, again, depending on the time of year, it could be, this isn't so bad, or this is actually pretty good. That could be the thought bubble. You know, we've got Bianco.
Right. At least we've got Bianco.
That could be it.
This isn't so bad. I get offended when people complain about Phoenix. It's okay if I
right.
do it, but I don't.
Exactly.
If you don't live here, I don't want to hear it.
That's exactly right. You know, right. I grew up LDS and am not anymore. And when people criticize the Mormon faith and they're not Mormon, I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about. Of course, I will do it all day long.
Right. But right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I know how bad Phoenix is. You don't.
Exactly.
Well, the one I wanted to submit is leave me alone.
That's here?
Here,
oh.
Yeah. And now I don't mean that in the sense that people are trying to isolate or not participate, but I do oftentimes have the sense here that people feel emboldened or empowered to express something about themselves that if they are a transplant, which we have a lot of,
yeah.
to your point, Amber, this seems to be a place where they feel like they can really do that. And they have enough physical space here in the vastness of the desert
sure.
to really deeply engage with that thing.
I mean, if you want to move to a part of America, maybe this is less the case than it was 20 years ago, and you want a, you know, third acre lot, and this is where you came. The lots are huge. Even if you live in the city, you've got plenty of elbow room.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there are so many people who are craving the opposite of that, though. Like, they want the community, and there's so few spaces to do that, and it's so hard to, like, get anywhere without a car, and it's like,
this is Gen Z nonsense and propaganda.
15
I'm kidding. I think you're right.
Ooh,
you're totally
ooh.
Right.
Controversy on the culture.
Yeah, total controversy. No, I mean, what's happened to downtown and the density culture is so awesome. I mean, it's so much. It just provides a dimension the city never had before.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, in closing, I wondered if you could each share a moment. Craig, you've been here for, you said, about a little more than 25 years.
27, half my life.
Okay.
Yeah. That Amber, occurred to me the other day. Yeah.
You've been here for about five, Amber?
Almost five, yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I wonder if you could each share just a moment where you felt like you had really arrived in Phoenix and were having a really Phoenix-specific experience.
For me, you know, I moved here and knew two people, and they took me to their favorite places, which was Bianco.
Mm-hmm.
And
at least we have it.
Squaw Peak, now Piestewa Peak. And that was the thing that I loved. I mean, both those things, but especially the peak. You know, it became my church. I go there every Sunday.
Mm.
I hike it. I listen to the music. I mean, it's just awesome. It's an amazing thing, a gift to have in the middle of a metropolitan area.
Yeah.
And it showed, you know, I flew in for my job interview. You fly into Sky Harbor. Sometimes Phoenix isn't going to overwhelm you with beauty from that, necessarily from that perspective. But from the top of the peak, I saw the true beauty of the city, and,
yeah.
you know, it never has left me.
Amber, what about you?
I guess when I realized that I was in Arizona is when I was walking around at night with a jacket instead of a water bottle, and I almost passed out when I first got here. But when I really felt like I was someone in the community and I had like really arrived is this past October. I organized a house show in my backyard, and I did not think anyone was going to come. I was really worried. But we asked people to dress up, and people came, and they dressed up, and they put money in our hurricane relief donation bucket. And, you know, there was a lot of dust that got kicked around in my backyard, and I thought it was really awesome that there were, like, so many strangers in my yard. Like, who would have thunk, you know? It was cool.
No, leave me alone there.
No, exactly. The people want community.
Okay. Well, this has been the first edition of the show's Culture Cap. And listeners, we would like to encourage you, if you agree with the things we've said, if you disagree, send us a note. Email us at theshow@kjzz.org. My thanks to Amber Victoria Singer and Craig Outhier.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, did you know Arizona has its own version of Burning Man? We'll get an inside look at what enthusiasts, call Saguaro Man. But first, Republican Congressman Juan Sisgamani, the U.S. representative for Arizona's 6th District, was recently named vice chair of the Conservative Climate Caucus. On the group's website, under a section called What We Believe, the caucus declares that, quote, the climate is changing and decades of global industrial era that has brought prosperity to the world has also contributed to that change. The section goes on to hail private sector innovation and fossil fuels as the key to both American prosperity and reducing emissions. Yesterday, I got the opportunity to speak with Congressman Sisgamani about the Conservative Climate Caucus and how he sees the group playing a role in climate-related policymaking.
This is a very important aspect of our district overall. Obviously, climate and making sure that we have both a protection of our incredible environment, but also at the same time, simultaneously, be able to promote economic development. And the Conservative Climate Caucus does that, right? It has a balance of the approach on how can we protect the environment, especially in a beautiful state like Arizona, where we're known for our outdoors and we're also known for the Grand Canyon, of course. And we're also the copper state where we have mining and we have things that are vital to the economy and the history of our state.
So I know that a significant part of the caucus's efforts are around reducing regulation on private industry, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
That's part of it. So it's promoting policies that advance the clean energy technologies and focuses on unleashing the American energy response to lower costs and so on. And part of that is the regulation. Like I said, always balancing that with protections for the environment.
So how do you see a less regulated private sector as being in service of reducing emissions overall?
I'll give you an example. The Critical Mineral Consistency Act, that's one of the bills that I introduced. It passed last Congress on a bipartisan basis. It basically ensures parity between critical minerals as defined by the Department of Energy and also critical minerals defined by the U.S. Geological Survey. So we have a clear demand for clean energy and critical minerals that continues to grow as we do more electric vehicles or we're looking at solar energy and so on. These are all critical elements of that. And when we are making it more friendly on the business environment for mines to be able to deliver on the demand for copper, for example, by copper being listed on the critical mineral list, then that also is able to speed up the process of being able to get it out of the ground and produce it. At the same time, we have to make sure that the mines, of course, as they do, are being friendly to the environment and they're recycling water and they're taking all the proper steps for that.
So how would you characterize the urgency of the overall mission of reducing emissions, though? Because, you know, as I'm sure you know, the administrator of the EPA, Lee Zeldin, has characterized a lot of the rollbacks on industry that he has proposed as, in his words, driving a dagger through the heart of climate change religion. How do you see the types of measures you're advocating for in relationship with that?
Well, one thing that I learned very quickly in Washington is that there are a lot of different players there. People are trying, they have different job descriptions. And people lose themselves in trying to comment and do things that are clearly not part of their jobs. So what I have always done is clearly just make sure that I stick to my job. And my job is to legislate. My job is to bring forward these bills that are going to produce what they're going to produce. Whether someone describes them in a different way in the administration, we're going to, you know, that's one way to go about that. I'm part of my job is to represent my district, and that's what I'm doing through this legislation. So, for example, again, I'll say the bill that I have here strengthens and safeguards both our domestic supply for these critical minerals. And this legislation passed on a bipartisan basis. Another example I'll give you, the clean energy tax credits. That's something that was key of the IRA. And we have to protect them here for my district. It's created jobs. I don't love everything and mostly not much of the IRA as big as a bill that it was. But this was a good aspect of it. So myself and 17 other Republicans wrote a letter to the chairman of Ways and Means to make sure that this is protected.
Yes, that makes sense. But I am curious to know, what is your position on the scientific perspective around climate change? Again, as I'm sure you know, the UN has advised that global emissions need to be reduced very drastically by 2030, or we will face, quote, abrupt, irreversible, and dangerous impacts for humanity. So while I hear you saying that you are advocating for these measures, how do you see the caucus interacting with the administration and the Senate on that?
Well, you know, we have to stay focused on what I can do, what I can impact, not only as a vice chair of the Conservative Climate Caucus, but just as the member of Congress in this area. And we all want to preserve and save our environment. And that's what's going to be the focus while we don't choke business out of existence and both sections of this can coexist.
Well, let me ask you this then, Congressman, if I could just switch gears. I want to talk about the budget, if I may. You recently signed a letter calling for the protection of Medicaid, but you also voted for a budget resolution that would seem to necessitate cuts to Medicaid. How would you reconcile those two things?
Well, I think it's a very important question, Sam, because when people hear that, they assume that the resolution that we voted for is the set in stone amount that needs to be found from that area. And that's not the case. What the resolution did that both the House and the Senate passed, it gives a blueprint of where the money needs to be found and the target amount as well for that. So the target was $880 billion over a 10-year period. We go back in this process now of the reconciliation process, as you rightfully differentiated, that will go probably the goal that we have is until Memorial Day. So you got another 4 weeks of this, of actually digging in and seeing where this money can come from. On work requirements, for example, when you have an able-bodied adult with no kids that is single, and that person is taking benefits off Medicaid from a single mother or a family in poverty or a disabled individual or the elderly, then that becomes a problem. And the improper payments that we've seen are as high as $100 billion in these improper payments. So when we tackle the improper payments, we tackle people that are the only people that are here legally to be able to receive these services, and we add things like work requirements, we can also make sure that we protect these services for the people that need it the most and the people that these programs were created to protect and serve.
So are you optimistic that there is an opportunity to find a substantial amount of that $880 billion without significant cuts to Medicaid?
I am. I'm optimistic that's the case. There's always cleanup to be made in these areas, and there's always waste and abuse and many times even fraud that can be found in these programs. But we have to protect the vitality of them. When you have a district like mine that it's maybe 22 to 24% we've seen of the population being on Medicaid, that becomes a top priority for me.
All right. Well, that is Juan Ciscomani, the U.S. representative for Arizona's 6th Congressional District. Congressman Ciscomani, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Sam. Always good to be on.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. New data from an organization that supports abortion rights find there were nearly 17,000 abortions in Arizona last year. That's about a 21% increase over 2023. The Guttmacher Institute also found a drop in the number of people traveling to a different state to obtain the procedure.
Isaac Maddow-Zimmet is a data scientist at the Guttmacher Institute. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about the numbers and what they mean. And they started with what stands out from this most recent batch of data.
Well, I think really two things would stand out. One of them is that we know that 2024 was a year in a lot of ways of enormous change in the abortion access landscape. In particular, Florida and Iowa both had six-week bans that were implemented, which really had major impacts on both residents of the state and the broader region. We also know that the funding environment more broadly for abortion care got really strained in 2024. So it's in that context that it's surprising that the number of abortions in states without total bans was largely unchanged from 2023 to 2024. I think in a lot of ways, that's masking a lot of change at the state level, however. Florida saw a huge decline in the number of abortions provided by 12,000 abortions, even though the six-week ban was just in effect for part of the year. And then in other states, we saw increases. And some of that is because policies in one state affect what's happening in other states. So Florida had a big decline, and then we saw a big increase in Virginia, which was in part driven by people traveling from Florida to Virginia for care as that ban went into effect.
So one of the states that had a fairly sizable increase in the number of abortions in 2024 compared to 2023 is, of course, Arizona. There are about 3,000 more here. Are you seeing the same kind of factors at play here as you were seeing in other places?
So Arizona is actually a little bit of a different situation. Part of what's going on in Arizona is that it's reflecting, this increase is reflecting an increase in a new mode of care in Arizona. So Arizona has a telehealth ban in effect for abortion, which can make it very hard to provide telehealth care to residents of the state. But starting in the second half of 2023, there started to be a somewhat new phenomenon, which is that providers in states with shield laws, so states like California or New York or Massachusetts, were sending medication and providing telehealth to residents of states with bans on abortion and with telehealth bans on abortion, Arizona being one of them. And so part of the increase we're seeing is this new mode of care of people accessing abortion through shield law provision from other states.
So it's not necessarily more visits to physicians in Arizona. It's Arizonans who are looking for this kind of care speaking with physicians online or on the phone in other places.
That's exactly right. So there's certainly a piece of that. We also know that people from Arizona do travel out of state to get care as well. So it's important to keep that in mind, too. Our most recent data there is from 2023 as compared to 2024. But we know that a lot of Arizonans in 2023 traveled to Nevada, California, and to some extent, New Mexico to access abortion care as well.
I'm curious what you are projecting, to the extent that you have projections for these kinds of things. What are you projecting in terms of what Arizona might look like in the next, let's say, year or two, given that voters here just enshrined abortion rights into the state constitution?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've really learned is it can be really hard to predict what's going to happen to abortion counts over time, in part because really what happens in one state really has ripple effects in a lot of other states as well. So what happens in Arizona in part depends on what happens in New Mexico or Colorado or Texas, because people certainly can travel out of state into the state for care. That hasn't happened a lot historically. There's not an enormous amount of people traveling to Arizona for care. That could change as clinic capacity increases, or it might not. It's one of those things that can be really, really difficult to predict. And I think that's one of the things that we've really learned as a result of doing this study is that whatever we think is going to happen isn't necessarily the thing that is going to happen.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned people traveling to other states. I'm curious what you saw related to that in Arizona in terms of both Arizonans traveling elsewhere and other people traveling to Arizona for abortion care. Was there a lot of that going on?
Yeah. So not an enormous amount of people travel to Arizona for abortion care. And in fact, there was a little bit of a decline from 2023 to 2024 in the number of people traveling. Only about 1% of abortions in Arizona in 2024 were to out-of-state residents. Part of that is because New Mexico and Colorado are both places where a lot of people seek care, particularly for people traveling from states like Texas. Just because New Mexico and Colorado, to some extent, are closer, people are often looking to travel to the place that is closest to them. That still often is hundreds of miles. But because cost really goes up so much as people have to travel farther, really one of the main places that we see in the Southwest for people traveling to is New Mexico. We don't have updated data yet in terms of people from Arizona traveling to other states. But we know for 2023, more than around 2,000 people from Arizona traveled to other states for care.
So you mentioned that it's very hard to predict what's going to happen. Are you still seeing a lot of law changes as it relates to abortion rights, either through state legislatures or through legal challenges to existing laws? Like, is there a lot of uncertainty as it relates to what the policies of a particular state are going to be going forward?
Yeah, I think there's two things in particular that we're really keeping an eye on. One of them is that a lot of what is driving the abortion access landscape in the U.S. right now is an enormous amount of travel across state lines, which to some extent is a feature of many states having extremely restrictive policies in place and some states having much more protective laws. You know, we estimate that in 2024, 155,000 people traveled across state lines to access abortion care. Mm. That's more than double the number of people who traveled in either 2019 or 2020. That travel can only happen because of an enormous amount of funding support, often from abortion funds, from practical support organizations, from clinicians. And what we've seen in general is that a lot of those folks got big increases in donations right after the Dobbs decision. And then as need has only increased, those donations have fallen off. And so one thing I think that we're keeping a close eye on is the sustainability of this broader funding network that has really allowed people to access care across the country. So certainly that's one change that we're keeping an eye on. The other one, I think, is that telehealth has started to play a bigger and bigger role in terms of abortion provision nationally. It's also certainly the target of legal attacks and policy changes, and any restrictions on telehealth care, either at the state level or nationally, I think really could create big barriers to access and could see having fairly major impacts.
All right. That is Isaac Maddow-Zimmet, a data scientist at the Guttmacher Institute. Isaac, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you've never been to Burning Man, the mysterious annual gathering in a remote section of the Nevada desert, chances are you don't know much about it. Burners, as the event's attendees call themselves, often describe Burning Man as an experiment in art, community, self-expression, and self-reliance. Every year, tens of thousands of burners make the trek to Black Rock Desert, where over the course of a week, they build a city from scratch, filling the temporary structures with sculpture, music, and dancing, and then they destroy the whole thing, leaving no trace that they were ever there. Burning Man started in the 1980s, and it's gotten so popular that there are now what are known as regional burns, smaller-scale versions of the event that happen all over the country, including right here in Arizona. Arizona's burners call their event Saguaro Man, and it starts today. I've never been to a burn, but I have always been fascinated by the group's improvisational, wildly ambitious spirit. And as I was perusing the AZ Burners website, I discovered a page called the 11 Principles. I'd always sort of assumed that burns were kind of a chaotic, freewheeling environment, and I was intrigued by the idea that this group of happy-go-lucky idealists are governed by a specific code. So we reached out to a representative from AZ Burners named Armella Gaines, and I had her walk me through the 11 principles and why she finds them meaningful. We started with principle number one, radical inclusion.
When you are out and about in the default world, we call the default world the place that is not a burn, just your home life, your regular day-to-day. So in the default world, if you walk up to a group of people dancing, maybe outside, and somebody's playing music real loud, and you hear that song and you love that and you want to dance with them. In the default world, sometimes it's not safe to just walk up and join in.
Right.
But at a burn, because of radical inclusion, you can be assured that the default is please join in. Mm. We're ready for you. We have extra food. We want to feed you.
Okay. Yeah, so okay. So it's like everybody's invited, everybody's welcome sort of thing.
Everyone.
Well, let's talk then about the next one, which is gifting.
So gifting is, we are a gifting economy, which means there's no cash, no money, there's no bartering, there's no exchange. So for instance, each camp will think of something they want to gift to the community. It might be pancakes. It might be like a pancake breakfast.
Got it. Got it. And just to be clear, a camp is a group of people who come to a burn together.
Yes.
Okay.
It is.
So the next two, maybe we could take the next two together, are radical self-reliance and radical self-expression.
It's for you to kind of decide who you are without all the constraints of your job and your bills and all of that kind of stuff. Like, who are you? Are you an artist? Are you a builder? And self-reliance, I always think that's kind of a joke one, because no matter what you do, you will never have everything you need when you go to the burn. And the community is there to kind of back you up and help you. Mm-hmm. When my first day at Burning Man, I didn't have shade over my tent. I had my tent and I had things to work with the dust, and I had it all set up, but I didn't have shade. And a woman walked up to me and she was like, "What are you putting over your tent?" And I didn't have anything. And she says, "I'll be right back." And she came back with a tarp and poles. And then the guy on the other side of me, he is a construction guy. And I only know because he walked over with his super huge Thor size hammer. And he hammered in the stakes for me, and they erected the shade over my tent. And they were just like, "All right, I'm leaving on Tuesday next week, so I'll need it back before then, but you're free to use it until then."
That also seems related to another one of the principles, which is decommodification.
Yes, decommodification. So at a festival, you buy a ticket to go see a show. You're going to watch other people do things. At a burn, you're buying a ticket to get in and do the show. When you first go, you might not have an idea of something you want to do, but within hours, you will see something you're interested in. Go check that out and just become a part of it.
Where does the money for the tickets go?
So the money for the tickets goes to permitting, medical. We also pay for the sheriff's. Fire is paid for. And they do shifts and make sure we're safe and not doing things dangerous.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so let's talk about, I think some of the other principles here are communal effort and civic responsibility. I feel mm-hmm. like the answers you've given cover those pretty well. But let's talk about this radical self-expression piece.
Yes. So maybe you grew up in a town where, you know, nobody was allowed to wear short dresses, but you wanted to wear a short dress. Or there are people who do spinning fire and people who do acrobatics in the air, like aerial acrobatics. So that's all self-expression, things that you can't do in the default world.
So if I'm hearing you right, it's almost like if there's something you've been curious about or something you've wanted to try, but for whatever reason felt like you couldn't, it's the radical part of it is like you have permission to try anything.
Yeah. And then because I know how people are, I always remind that radical self-expression, because sometimes it can be clothing, it could be no clothing, it could be whatever, but you also have to keep in mind consent, the 11th principle. So then that shows, for instance, okay, so you want to have a nude camp, completely nude, right? But I'm camping next to you and I don't consent to just, you know, being around the nudity. So then in that case, the two camp managers would talk and they would make an agreement. And maybe the agreement is, okay, we're going to move to another location just so both of us can be happier. Or maybe we park all of the RVs on this road between our camps so that, you don't have a clear view of what we are doing over here.
Yeah, it sort of forces you into having a difficult conversation when, or potentially difficult conversation when there's disagreement, which, to use Burning Man lingo, in the default world, people don't always have those conversations. But it seems like these principles are sort of encouraging you to engage with stuff, even if it might be a difficult situation to navigate.
Yeah. I think the thing is, at Burning Man, I can trust that 9 times out of 10, the neighbor next to me also knows the 10 principles and lives by them. And I know I can go to them and say, hey, I need, you know, some adjustments, or let's see if we can work together. And then it becomes a conversation and not an argument. You're not trying to win something. You're just trying to get along.
Right. So let's talk about the last two of the core 10 principles, because they also seem to be related: participation and immediacy.
Participation goes back to that thing, that word that we hate. We hate when people say it's a festival, not a festival. At a festival, you pay to go see a show. At a burn, it is a no spectator event. There are no spectators. Everyone is to participate.
And what about the immediacy piece?
Immediacy is my number one, most favorite one, because I went through life not being immediate. Like, I would see a friend would be having an event or something, and I wouldn't go because I would be something. At the event, they would be dancing, and I wouldn't want to dance because I'd be embarrassed. Somebody might look at me and think, oh, she can't dance. And even if they didn't, I just would feel so self-conscious.
Mm-hmm.
But in the world of the Burning Man universe, I guess, immediacy, you can feel safe to jump onto the dance floor and dance any way you like. And you're going to be fine. No one is going to make fun of you. In fact, you might see other people dancing the same way. but immediacy causes you, like, don't hesitate. Don't be afraid to do the thing that your heart wants you to try.
Well, Armella Gaines is a representative from the AZ Burners community, and Saguaro Man takes place April 23rd through the 27th. Armella, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, good luck out there in the default world, friends. And thank you, as always, for making the show a part of your morning. Remember that you can reach us via email, theshow@kjzz.org, where we welcome your reactions to today's Culture Cap or anything else you heard on the show. We will be back here tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you then.